Blog Talk Radio.
Author of Nobody Cages Me, a book on Jimmy that showcases his versatility. And our guest here for this evening or tonight will be Cordell Dickerson. I'm very interested to hear what this brother has to say on Jimmy. For those who don't know, you're in for a treat if you don't know about Cordell. So let's go ahead and bring Cordell in. Cordell, are you there?
Yes, brother, I'm here, Corey. How are you tonight?
I'm doing pretty good. How about yourself?
I'm here waiting to speak with you, man.
Okay, that's good. Now, just kind of had a little intro song, but can you first just tell us a little bit something about yourself and maybe your connection to Jimmy and maybe some of the
sure.
events and programming that you participated in the past concerning Jimmy?
Well, again, my name's Cordell Dickerson. I was born in New Orleans, Louisiana, so I'm very, very, very close to music and the people who play it. I'm a guitar player myself, and I first heard Jimi Hendrix in 1966-67 while sitting by what we call at my home the magic window at my mother's kitchen at Marrero across the river from New Orleans. And Purple Haze came on the radio, and I just about fell out of my chair. I had never heard anything like that, and, you know, in the younger days, in the early to mid-60s, a lot of the younger musicians were hooking together amplifiers and various guitars, usually those Sears Silvertone models, which some of your audience may be old enough to remember, really cheap guitars that they'd hook together to see who could make the strangest sound. And I had never heard the sounds that had come out of a guitar like I heard on Purple Haze. So my interest in him continued throughout junior high, senior high, all through high school. And there was a considerable splash about him, shall we say, and it was connected with whether or not he was playing what is referred to as so-called black music or white music. And having grown up in the town where Louis Armstrong grew up, he said there are only two types of music, good music and bad music. We knew that we were the originators of a certain style and a certain type of music as black people in North America. And a lot of people didn't even realize at that time where rock and roll had its origin. And this is probably because of things done by Colonel Parker and Elvis Presley and other people who covered our songs. That has its place also. But what Jimmy was doing was really recovering, taking back a lot of that. I've done a lot of programs in Washington, D.C., which some of your audiences may have heard on the World Wide Web, over at WPFW, which is part of the Pacifica Network located. Our central node is in California, in San Francisco. The Pacifica Network is a, I guess some would say, a leftist-leaning network. Their network was actually part of a series of networks bombed by right-wing individuals in Texas in the late 60s and early 70s. So Pacifica was out there doing some good things, coming to the attention of some people who were not quite so good. Over the years, I've done at least, oh my goodness, quite a few shows related to Jimi Hendrix on PFW with my cohort in that effort, Mr. Bob Daughtry, who is one of the world's great musicologists and ethnomusicologists, and not even a musician. It's really incredible. You know, it takes Miles Davis, I guess, to tell you about people who are great musicians who are not musicians. If you ever heard Miles Davis talk about people who are capable of making observations, yes, he talks about people in those terms. I think Bob ought to be playing something to me. I see him behind the tenor sax. But over the years, I've had the pleasure to talk to many people. At this point, I would say that no longer being behind the control board of a radio, I'm still trying to do a few things, still speaking to people about Jimmy, still conducting interviews, and preparing to put together a book myself.
Okay. Now, do you have any plans in the future to maybe be on radio, either in some sort of capacity, or is that not in the works yet?
I'm still looking for that. Looking for that. The type of music that I would play in that case would have to be played at a certain time of day, sometime between 10 p.m. and 5 a.m. when the melatonin level is really high in the human system and people are more reticent or more easily swayed, shall we say, toward exploration sonically. Any show that I would have musically would definitely not be primetime drive music. It would be of a highly exploratory nature, and of course Jimmy would have his place there. But I am always looking for a way to get back into that. If anybody is listening, I know a lot of people listen to your show.
Okay, definitely would be a great asset to the Atlanta area.
We'll keep our hopes up.
Okay, now when we talk about Jimi Hendrix, as you said in your intro, you were at a very unique position because you heard him at the early stages, as when many his transition from R&B to, you know, what they would call rock music, but some would say he was always doing rock. But how would you consider his had you heard Jimmy before then as far as playing any of his R&B stuff, or was his first introduction just his straight Purple Haze and that was it?
Well, I was aware, but his first introduction to me was definitely rock. There were little cul-de-sacs of what I would call advanced soul music being played. If you listen to Jimmy's soul music, the work with Lonnie Johnson, stuff like Wipe the Sweat and other titles like that, you can hear that he was taking chances sonically that no other guitar player was taking at that time. He was doing things on those records that made some people even go so far as to turn down his level in the studio. I was a gentleman called the Hoss Man, who used to come on the radio some time ago, Had Jimmy in his studio. I believe that was when they were in the Deep South with Billy Cox. And heard Jimmy's playing and just turned it down on the level. That's the degree to which he struck people. But, yes, I first heard him in straight rock. Older guitar players told me that the stuff that he was playing was coming from a much, much older blend, a much older group of guitar players, and that the blues would always be king, you see. Even the heaviest rock riffs have their origin in that blues connection, right? That the blues is central to it all. And he seemed to be playing in a way that the older blues musicians played, people like Charlie Patton. There was a time when the blues didn't have, say, 12 bars. It didn't resolve the way we have the bars resolving now in modern music. There were times when the musician would go off completely and play things that were unheard. That, to me, is the closest that he comes. The addition of electricity only served to make that sound wilder and to, you know, impact people's heads a little bit deeper.
Okay. Now, before
that
I
electric
get into
component,
my...
yeah, that's I first heard the rock stuff, but again, the rock stuff grew out of stuff that is old and primal. One of the musicians from New Orleans had a saying about the music. He said about the music. He said, "What I hear is old and has a lot of mud on it." You see. So when you think about people like Muddy Waters and whatnot, you're talking about that stuff, which is the first stuff that was ever done. It's primal. It's the stuff that you seek, you know, when you're in school, when you're in college. Your professor always tells you to get primary sources. Well, the blues is the primary source for heavy metal, for jazz, for rhythm and blues, for rock and roll, for soul, for just about everything that we have. All the blues is really, for me, having looked under so many rocks and stones, all the blues is for me is West African music played in North America, if you would.
Yeah, very interesting. Now, my next question, I'm going to preface it with a clip. I want you to listen to it. Many of those in the know that Jimi Hendrix actually commented on Motown, but he was over in England. But I just want to play this clip for everybody and just take a listen to it.
Tell us the difference between a normal beat sound and what these people, like for instance, the Supremes are trying to do, the Detroit people.
Yeah.
What is Detroit sound?
Well, to me, you know, this might bring you down or something like that, but anyway, to me, it's like it's an artificial, you know, very, very commercial and very, very electronic made, very, you know, what is it, synthetic soul sound. It isn't the real sound of any, you know, like Negro artists singing, you know. It's so commercial, it's so put together, you know, so beautifully that I don't feel anything from it, except maybe the Isley Brothers are the only ones that, and maybe the Four Tops. But as far as the rest, this is my own opinion, you know. And all they do is put a very, very hard beat to it, you know, very good beat. They put about 1,000 people on tambourines and these bells, you know, and they got 1,000 horns, 1,000 violins, and then a singer, he overdubs his voice millions of times, or a singer, an echo chamber full of this and that, and it comes out, you know, to me, it comes out so artificial that, you know, but far as, you know, it has a very good beat and it sounds very good, you know, it's very commercial for the younger people.
Now, we just heard Jimmy being interviewed overseas, and, you know, he was pretty much asked the question, but it was kind of interesting on what he said. What is your take on what he said since you lived through that era of Motown?
Well, there's a group of musicians that Motown used. I believe they used to call themselves the Blues Brothers or the Soul Brothers, and God forgive me for not remembering
Funk
at
Brothers.
This very moment. The Funk Brothers, yes. And as we know, there were a group of way super competent musicians. The mixing and the manipulation that takes place in the studio is necessary in the case of reverb and whatnot to create a certain studio ambience on music in general. But you know, Jimmy's opinion on Motown at that time is probably again, his own special way of looking at that. Not so much surprised. There's another interview similar to that one where he said that in the United States, either you're Frank Sinatra or you're something else. And he said he would have chosen Frank Sinatra. And, you know, with Jimmy, he listened to so much of everything. His really decrying of Motown at that time, he went kind of far there. I've never heard that interview before, and there's very few that I haven't heard. But, again, that's his opinion there. And there are some things I think that he would have went very well on. As a matter of fact, I have some photographs of him playing with King Curtis. And if you've ever heard King Curtis's recording, they're as well produced as the things that were produced at Motown. What you have there is what you call top 40 soul. But again, the type of advanced soul that Jimmy wanted to play would probably not have been welcome by then. And by the time that interview took place, he was getting to actually stretch. Getting to really stretch in the studio instead of people freaking out when he would use feedback and whatnot on a song. He was now with people that he was had first gotten to London who would encourage him to do things that was really not encouraged when he was here just before he left to go overseas, to go to the UK. So it probably, who knows, maybe the comments come from being free all of a sudden. To be able to do those things, because as you know, when Jimmy got on stage and did them, a lot of people would say, "You got to turn that down. You know, you got to do something else with that." If you listen to that live version of Voodoo Child on Electric Ladyland, after Jimmy comes out of a certain feedback barrage, there's a brother who's back there, and he says, "Turn that damn guitar down." And if you listen to it, it's there. It's right there. So there's a brother in the audience who is enjoying the music, but for him, it's still too loud. So, like I said, perhaps Jimmy is saying that from the standpoint of finally being free to get to do what he does. I don't think Motown deserves that, but, you know, I love Jimmy, but I don't agree with everything that he said.
Yeah, that was a pretty interesting. I have my own take on it, but I'll say that for another time. But,
sure, we can do it again.
Yeah. Now, Jimi Hendrix, just a little, you know, I don't want to interject myself too much into the interview, but, you know, I come from a position of somebody that saw Jimi Hendrix every now and then. Every time I would see him, it would be a Woodstock presentation or just him with Mitch and Noel. Never knew anything about the Band of Gypsies, never saw him around a lot of black people. But as we know now, you know, once you dig deep into Jimmy, his roots are deeply entrenched in black music, and, you know, he never really left it. You know, it's just a perception. So how is your take on the way that Jimmy has been marketed throughout the years? Because you've been there since 66, 67. You've seen how he was marketed in the 70s, which, you know, after he died wasn't much. In the 80s wasn't much. And maybe a resurgence with this experience Hendrix. So what's your take on how he's been marketed throughout the years and why he hasn't been particularly marketed toward blacks or urbans or people of color in that sense?
Well, this goes to who controls the business. I give you an example. I was having a kind of a loud discussion, shall we say, with some individuals who really did not know a whole lot about music, and their take was particularly negative. But Jimmy himself was also very concerned about who he was being marketed to. He was definitely not marketed to what were then black soul, R&B, rhythm and blues in the true sense, not in the sense people use the word rhythm and blues now, real rhythm and blues stations. They did not think it would be profitable to even point him in that direction. As a result, you know, we got that famous incident that took place in Harlem where the people simply were not ready for him, even there, even in the capital of the entertainment industry on the East Coast. A lot of people in the community were still not ready for him. And I realized that when he returned, meeting up with the same old thing from many of the people that he started developing his career from, probably made him feel a little more than a little bit strange, because here he would come back to New York City to visit people like the Alims and Fane and other people, and still have them say, "What do you mean you have an album? The man is famous. He's done his thing. He's got Are You Experienced out?" And yet they don't know who it is or what he's talking about, which really speaks to the power of the people who control this industry. Really, even to this day, even though we have a larger amount of black musicians here, particularly the young people who are now making a lot of money and who largely control their own destiny, there was a large sacrifice to be made for that, because all Jimmy wanted to do was play music. He was in many ways very, very free with his money, and it made it so that he only saw it as a means to an end to achieve another level on that guitar, to perhaps develop the next tool, to try the next recording technique. But again, you see, when we're talking about being marketed, we're talking about Warner Reprise. We're talking about Warner Brothers Reprise, Frank Sinatra's Bunch. I'm thinking of him playing the lines from Strangers in the Night at Monterey. Many people think that was a little jab at the time, because that was a huge song when Jimmy was playing Monterey that year. And they were both on the same label. You see, so Jimmy had his way of addressing those types of things too. If he played a snippet from the song, he was telling people, "Yes, ladies and gentlemen, this is wild, crazy, spacey music. I am your pilot on this spaceship, and here's a little jab at the commerciality of the record company for which even I work." You know, Jimmy was very, very heavy. Many of his side comments and little flickers of things that he would play were actually his jabs at whatever he chose to pick on at that day, at that time. So marketing, yeah, he definitely was not marketed to the black community. You just had to be in the know. You just plain had to be in the know. To hear him at that time. The thing, the radio stations were as segregated as much of North America was at that time. There were people in the dominant population who thought that they were extremely advanced because they listened to a black radio station where they could hear the actual blues. So, yes, his marketing was definitely not to that community. No.
Now, some of the things that I've uncovered in my own journey to Jimi Hendrix, you know, I knew Parliament Funkadelic. I didn't get really deep into Parliament Funkadelic until the rappers started sampling their music. Then that's when I went back and discovered, you know, all of that great P-Funk stuff. And I knew about, you know, different styles of funk and things like that, but it wasn't until later that I made the connection between Jimi Hendrix and the funk of the 70s, because, you know, before Jimi Hendrix, you know, like you were saying earlier, you couldn't really find many black people playing loud guitar with these wild, crazy, loud solos on the guitar until Jimi Hendrix came along. And then when he died, you know, you had Parliament Funkadelic, Slave, Ohio Players, all these people pretty much paying tribute to Jimmy with their music. You know, might have not been the whole album, but what's your take on that Jimi Hendrix connection to the funk of the 70s?
Well, you know, the stuff Jimi Hendrix played was super loud blues. I mean, really to get right to the point, I guess, if you were to put Purple Haze on right now, that song is quite funky for a funky LSD trip, or whatever it is you're going to call it. You know, I mean, the beat is there. It's all there. That song is low down.
Mm-hmm.
That song is low down. And upon first hearing it, it took a lot of people for a loop. I think the use of the interval, that tritone, that fifth, that that jarred a lot of people, and that volume connected with his voice, you know, connected with the voice of, actually, you know, when you hear it, you know it was somebody black singing.
Yeah.
A lot of people say that he didn't have that great a voice, but that delivery, his voice is perfect to deliver everything that he ever wrote. That's the perfect voice for it. And I'm sorry, let me get back to the essence of your question. You were saying that what again? I'm sorry.
when you listen to funk in the 70s, you see
right,
a lot of people.
The connection with Funkadelics. Yes. Well,
right.
This, remember that first Funkadelic album, Funkadelic, Funkadelic, the one with music of my for my mother and whatnot on it, that was done in the extreme late 60s, early 70s. That first album came out in 1970. So you see, when you start drawing that timeline, you got the whole 60s that have gone by with the evolution of R&B, rhythm and blues and soul. It's electrification somewhere with the electrification of the blues. You see, people like Muddy and Buddy Guy, when those guys first electrified their instruments in the late 50s and early 60s, what you're hearing there coming out of Chicago with Buddy Guy and people like that is the first heavy metal. That is the first heavy metal. The first electrified blues that you hear is the first heavy metal to exist. So when you're listening to those first electrified blues recordings, that's the heavy stuff. He went back and listened to that stuff, and the fact that George heard it, George Clinton heard it, after he was doing stuff like I Want to Testify, and he realized that this stuff had some extremely deep roots. Again, remember that first album, Funkadelic, that's 1970. Boom. So we're talking about almost the end of things. So by that time, when rock came on the scene, the second album is coming out, what, Free Your Mind? And, wow, that thing really threw a lot of people for a loop also. But, you know, George made for an audience because he kept this thing rooted in the blues, kept it rooted in funk, and that connection was obvious to a lot of people. I believe that there were many other brothers out there who also played the guitar in an unusual way. Of course, in the Funkadelics, we had Brother Eddie Hazel.
Right.
And we had other people, too. There was a brother by the name of Alfonia Timms who had a group called the Flying Tigers.
Hmm.
And there were a couple of others. Of course, there was Arthur Lee and the group Love. So I believe that there were probably other black people out there doing rock or advanced soul music or rock-like music, who simply didn't get promoted because by the time Jimmy came along in the mid-60s and went to 67, he frightened people in the industry so very badly that a lot of people said, okay, if you're out there scouting, we already have one guitar player who has pretty much wiped everybody else off the table. He happens to be black, so that slot is filled. In a very strange way for the industry, he became kind of like the Negro du jour, you know, only accepting one black person in one position and one type of music at a time. And in rock, Jimmy was it. You know,
so you
that,
think that's why after
fear.
He died, a lot more people started to do that style in music, like all those groups I mentioned, because they had some pretty wild rock stuff eventually.
Yes, they did. And those are the type of things that you would have to hear at certain times of the day or night. I know for a fact when Funkadelic's first album came out in late 69, early 70s, they were on the Westbound record label, and there was no distributor for Westbound Records in New Orleans. So the way we got those records was to have our relatives send them to us from Detroit.
Hmm.
And that's how that music came to be known. That's how hard it was to get a hold of that sort of thing right here in North America, not in some far-off country where people are at war and don't, you know, have record players and records to play them on. That happened right here, you see. But other rock groups, of course, didn't have that trouble, that question of circulation and whatnot. But the issue of rock itself, rock had been carved out as a part of what blues did, as a part of the entire segregation thing. One of the things I did in Washington, D.C., was I worked at the Library of Congress for quite a few number of years. And a great revelation I had one day walking in there was when I looked at the first documents to copyright the first country music written in this country. It was virtually all African Americans, hardcore country music. But something happened. Someone in power who had the power to draw down a curtain to say that, well, these people started this music, they started writing it. Here are the first copyrighted written examples that really show that, but we're going to push that music toward another group of people. We're going to market that music to another group of people, and we're going to change the course away from its origin to something else. That's the way things happened here. There's a large amount of manipulation that goes on. Again, who would guess that the first purveyors of hardcore country music were African Americans, were black people in this country? Yet that is the case. But you look at country music now, and when the Country Music Awards come on, you don't see anybody's face who looks like that even now. That's how immense that marketing power is, that power to change people's perception about who did what musically, who's responsible for the groove altogether. You have people coming on as though they've always been part of it, and really nothing could be further from the truth.
That's
so, you know, when those guys like the Bar Kays came out with an album called Black Rock, which you probably have in your collection, I brought that album just because that's what it said on the cover. And they were attempting to do a form of advanced soul. It actually wasn't Black Rock. There were one or two things happening on there. Young brother, 19 years old, I forget his name. He was an exceptional guitar player. And that was the closest that a lot of people could get to Black Rock. But the same summer Black Rock was released, Funkadelic's third album, Maggot Brain, was released, 1971. And those brothers were truly... Funkadelic used to be a group to be feared, brother. Used to be a group to really be feared. Those records were not supposed to exist, but there they are.
Man.
Always
and
will,
you know,
love them.
You mentioned something, and it goes back to what we see today in hip-hop. When you mention when people look around and they forget the history of it, they won't know the originators. You'll see Eminem listed in a history book, a Macklemore, you know, people that won these awards, and people
that's
growing
right
up today, they might think, hey, these guys originated this stuff, but that's farthest from the truth.
Yeah,
so,
yeah. And of course, you know, cultural memory is very, very important. Cultural memory is very important. A lot of people now want to make certain sounds and they want to do certain things, but they're unaware of the level that current things are at. Right now we have a group of people who know little or nothing about music but are just bent on putting forth a show. You know, it's entertainment. A lot of it is not particularly high-reaching, but this is what people are perceiving now as music. The next group of people that come around to do it are really going to throw the public for a loop because most people will not be ready for it. Now, in Jimmy's case, for him to have been around now, and a lot of people have disagreed with me on this, but I believe that if Jimi Hendrix had survived and what happened on September 18th, 1970 had not happened, there would be no hip-hop.
Mm.
There would be no acid jazz. There would be no funk. There would be no punk music. The presence of a person of that caliber is enough to change the direction of popular music on its own. So when he was taken away, in 1970, people continued to experiment in high musical order right up until about 1975, 76 with the advent of disco. And that's when you saw punk come in. That's when you saw the first rap come in. That's when I first heard the Sugar Hill Gang, late 75, early 76. And I listened and I say, wow, that's kind of interesting. I say, wow, but there's no solo. Brothers doing the same thing over and over and over again. And I waited because I said, okay, now there's got to be some more music in there. You see, but what we saw was what we saw, you know, when great civilizations fall. You have that rhythm that's going, but no ability to fill in what's between. The between stuff is what's important. I think that had Jimmy been around, he would have continued to inspire people. What we have right now is in the mid-70s also was the advent of another music, which is called fusion. Now, that's a bad word for a lot of people, but they should remember that that type of music really came about as a result of conversations that Jimi Hendrix had with Miles Davis just before he left to go back to London for the last time in August of 1976. Out of that, you have people like Return to Forever. You have Lenny White. You've got Al DiMeola. You've got people exploring this thing from all sorts of different angles. He would have had so very much to do with that because the jazz is in there, the blues is in there, the rock is in there. But his non-presence is what caused that whole thing to kind of go into what we call, I guess for lack of better words, a dark age. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Okay. Now we're kind of getting to, we've got about 10 more minutes in the interview, so I'd be remiss if I didn't touch on the subject of Jimmy's death. But before we do that, I wanted you to listen to a clip. Just listen to this clip with me for a second here.
Sure.
Music has a lot of influence on a lot of young people today. You know, politics are getting, well, I don't know. You know how they get it. You know, a cat that talk on TV, a cat in Mississippi, a farmer in Mississippi, can't barely understand him except when he says America, you know. So then he's going to vote for him. But through music, it's all true, either true or false, you know. And like such a large gathering of people with music, it shows that music must mean something.
Now, Jimmy, that's just a small snippet of something he said, but, you know, if you go back and you study his interviews, especially from 69, 70, before his death, you would hear him increasingly laying out a platform, and which was very dangerous to the powers that be, whoever you may think those people are. Can you talk a little bit about Jimmy's, you know, powerful words, you know, without even saying much? You know, just that little clip, you know, he almost wanted to go into it more, but he stopped himself. Well, you know how they're getting, you know. He elaborated in some other interviews, but then people may not know about. But just talk from your perspective on those comments and other comments that may have gotten a brother killed.
Well, for me, there is a book that Bill Natope wrote a little while ago. It's full of Jimmy's writings, his handwritten scribblings and notes. And for whatever people think about what Jimmy was saying, that also that may have gotten him into trouble, I always direct him to that final set of poems that he wrote, which appears as the last piece in Bill Natope's book. And he talks about how black is the original kings of the earth. We all had to go through a transformation in the 60s, moving from colored to black, and even more recently to African American. But the transition from colored to black was the one that was the most violent, the one that required real consciousness of the type you hear people talk about in The Matrix, where Neo is telling people what happens when you wake up. That there's of necessity a certain amount of violence connected with waking up. And Jimmy talked about people who needed to destroy, and he talks about how our drums are facing the South. There's a lot of things that the brother's talking about that really are not things that are common to a person that really they wanted to bring down to the so-called raceless. I say that again, raceless Jimi Hendrix. A lot of his marketing going back to that had to do with a lot of attempting to confer upon him this label of racelessness. You know, people would say, well, I don't think of Jimmy as black. I just think of him as Jimmy. Well, if you don't think of Jimi Hendrix as black and don't see him as black, then that's a real problem.
Mm.
He said many things, especially as we get to the end. You know, he was talking about beaming sound out over several hundred square miles. He was talking about the fact that sound at certain frequencies could heal people of certain physical ailments. He was talking about how you could do things like cause certain machinery to not work if certain frequencies were played at certain places on the earth. Most recently, you know, he's even been connected with other phenomena. There's a hard political side to this, and there's an esoteric side to it. And, you know, there's this event that many people in your audience may have heard about. It's called the Battle of Los Angeles. Occurred in February of 1942, where this large object appeared over the city of Los Angeles and was actually fired upon by the United States Army. I just looked at the date, and I realized that it was 9 months almost to the day when Jimmy was born. And toward the end of his career, he talked about what people would do if they saw one of these objects, and he started talking about how they would probably shoot it down. And this event occurred almost exactly 9 months from his birthday. His strange connections and the connections with what he said directly and or indirectly, that's all Jimmy. And I'm sure that many people were listening to that, 67, 68, 69. Remember back in 1968, Seattle was the number one hot spot in the country for clashes between the police and the Panthers and other youth-oriented groups. And, you know, a lot of people were wondering in law enforcement, well, what in the world is going on in Seattle? You know, and in my artist's mind, I picture one morning where all these agents are sitting down in their office, and one guy runs in the office one morning with a piece of paper and goes, boss, I got it. I got the Seattle connection. And somebody goes, Jimi Hendrix is from Seattle. So you see, a lot of people think that a lot of what Jimmy said is not was not capable of energizing people to do anything. But that's the only connection that a lot of people made with why all this hardcore radical stuff was coming out of Seattle in 1968. Many people traced that to the place that he was from. So, and there's many other things that he said, too, which I'm sure we'll probably talk about more in the future. But yes, he did say a lot of things which made him come to the fore with some people that weren't so nice. And you know, COINTELPRO was set up, even in its own wording, to deal with what are called potential messiahs. And that, as much as a lot of people would not like to admit it, that did include Jimi Hendrix also.
Right, definitely. His files haven't really been opened up yet to the public, have they, his FBI files?
Oh, yeah, those files were open, but they're extremely redacted, not even worth reading.
Yeah,
not even worth reading. The issue of his death and his passing is one that I hope to cover in a book that I hope to be soon finished. The book will be called Obakoso. It is in the Yoruba reading, and that the words mean the king did not hang. I see Hendrix as a kind of a drawback to kind of a hearkening back to the story of Shango and what happened to him. He had performed a ritual act with his axe, which controls electricity and magnetism, according to the Yoruba myth, that killed a village and several people, and that he became so depressed that he went off and hung himself. But people who are his adherents always say when lightning strikes, Obakoso, and Obakoso means that the king did not hang. So this book will deal with the fact that Jimi Hendrix did not commit suicide. It will be dealing with the fact that he was murdered on the morning of September the 18th, 1970. So again, it's going to be called Obakoso, and that's what we'll be calling it.
Okay. When you get everything straight, I definitely look forward to having you on again, and maybe we'll do something otherwise even before that.
It is my pleasure to be with you here tonight, Brother Corey.
Okay. Well, we thank you so much for sharing your knowledge with us. So we only got about two more minutes. Can you give me a short comment on the Band of Gypsies? I'm trying to see about getting them into some kind of Hall of Fame, rock and roll, R&B. But just what's your take on the Band of Gypsies just in about a minute?
The only black rock group ever to come to that fore of power. And what happened with the Band of Gypsies came to an untimely end there with the actions of Mike Jeffries at that concert, that really infamous show. But you couldn't find more power in any other group of three, any other brothers. Super powerful. You had the Funkin' Buddy. You had that laid-down line there with Billy. And Jimmy just cleared the room. So that room, a group like that, fully empowered, would have taken over everything, but Mr. Jeffries had his own agenda. I guess we'll talk about that, you know, at another time. But yeah, the Band of Gypsies, should definitely be considered as a group, as short-lived as they were, and have their place also in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Okay.
Could even go a long way toward getting other black rock groups in there today.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Okay,
yeah.
Well, we thank you a lot, Brother Cordell Dickerson, and look forward to your comments in the future.
Thank you so much, Corey. Have a great night.
Okay, you too.
Bye-bye.
All right, bye. So that was Cordell Dickerson, and once again, this is Corey Washington, author of Nobody Cages Me, signing off for the Jimi Hendrix Black Legacy series. Good night.